and welcome to the latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast, hosted by Data Protection People. My name is Ollie Rear, and I am joined, as ever, for the purposes of this introduction, by Mr. David Holmes and producer Miles. Hello, chaps.
Hello.
Afternoon, Ollie.
Won't bad that one. I put a little bit more into it because these two encouraged me off air to try and really go Good Morning Vietnam with it. But we're all in a really quite a good mood, actually. I think I speak for all of us because we've just come off what I thought was a really interesting session with Mr. Stuart Golding on the topic of the PCI DSS, particularly version 4. And this session came about basically because one of our guys, you know, is pretty hot on PCI. Is aware of version 4 coming out, wants to create a session. Now, unfortunately, our two QSAs or our team of QSAs weren't available today, but Stuart very kindly stepped in, and he's a really, really knowledgeable guy. He's got some fantastic insights, and we had a fabulous chat with him, didn't we, Dave?
We did. It's similar to the ISO 27000, what we did the other week. I've come away learning more than what I did when I went in, which is always a good feeling. And it's again got some very, very good tips in there. There's some alliances and kind of crossover with where it meets the standards that we discussed. And I personally took a lot from that.
Yeah, no, as did I, because, you know, I think it's one of those things which I understand, and possibly actually better than ISO 27001 that we spoke about last week, at least from a conceptual point of view. But obviously the actual, you know, nitty gritty of the controls is still a bit beyond me. I'm certainly no QSA, let's be honest. But I thought it was really interesting. I think it's still quite approachable. And I think potentially we might look at organizing a follow-up session with Stuart, because there's still so much to talk about, particularly in respect to version 4 and the changes to come. But mainly we did cover, you know, what organizations need to be aware of and how they're supposed to prepare, didn't we, Dave?
We did, yeah. I mean, the second stage, and I'd like to do the second one if we can, to dig into the controls that you mentioned. But I think the takeaway from me from this really wasn't just the understanding of what it is now, not necessarily what the changes involve, but the fact that there's only a short lead-in period of about 2 years, and we need to be kind of assessing where we are now and what that looks like. And we shouldn't be taking our time over that. We need to be looking at doing gap analyses and understanding what that may mean for us. We shouldn't kind of sit around. I think the next one will be really interesting if we can dig into some of the controls and what the differences are and what it may mean, and what some of the complications or the added issues that may cause for organisations. But I thought it's a great session, and looking to de-scoping as well. I thought that was a really interesting way to try and limit the impact of this.
Yeah, absolutely. So plenty to talk about. I think you know, it's worth pointing out at this stage, as I did on the main session, that if you come away from listening to this thinking, oh God, I need to really sort myself out, I need to get ready for version 4, then it's worth remembering that Data Protection People are a QSA company. We can help you with any aspect of this, and Stuart is also vastly experienced in the area. You know, he's a really fabulous guy. He's got a real, you know, lots of value to engaging with Stuart. So if you need any assistance with that, reach out to us. We can help you. We can put you in touch with Stuart, etc. We're going to leave all of the relevant links to both our website and his in the description of this. So please do not hesitate to get in touch. We're here to help ultimately. Before we get stuck into it, because I don't want to keep the listeners too long, just a little bit of promo, more promo, in fact. We will be back next week with another episode, as I mentioned. GDPR Radio, one of the open surgery sessions, that promises to be quite good, because actually we've not done one in quite a while, and there's quite a few things to talk about, I think, Dave. So, you know, it'd be good to get stuck into one of those again. And after that, we've got, you know, loads of events coming up. So we've got, we had to, you know, make a couple of changes to the calendar, as Mar mentions, towards the end of the episode. Because we really wanted Carrie to be able to make the retention and archiving chat, because she's extremely knowledgeable on that topic. So I'm looking forward to that. She's equally knowledgeable on data breaches, which we've got two episodes dedicated to coming up. They're also set to be really, really good sessions. If you want to find out about any of the other events we're running, head to the DPP website. You can find out more and sign up for an invite to the live sessions. and find the recordings of all the previous episodes up there. And yeah, there's plenty to get stuck into. Last thing before we go, Dave started the shameless plug a couple of weeks ago, but the competition in the DPP offices is really heating up. If you enjoy the podcast, we'd really appreciate it if you could leave us a rating, whether that's on your streaming platform of choice, or if you could head over to Trustpilot, leave us a review on there. Name drop Dave and I. You know, there's a competition in the office to see who can get the most reviews. If you include the two of us, we'd really appreciate it.
Yeah, and you've really beat me to it. I was going to try and get the shameless plug back in because we're lagging behind everybody else. So if anybody out there is feeling a little sorry for the time that Ollie and I, or we'd appreciate the time that Ollie and I take to entertain you on a Friday through the lunchtime sessions, we'd really appreciate some positive news to see if we can stop Miles and his team from taking the glory.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not like producer Miles needs any more glory. Right, on that, he's already got his flashy new title. He likes producer Miles. Anyway, on that note, this is way more silliness than we had in the main episode. And that's really not a bad thing because we had, a really, really good chat with Mr. Stuart Golding. And on that note, I will let you get into that main session. Hope you enjoy. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to this latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast hosted by Data Protection People. My name is Ollie Rear. I will be your host for this afternoon. I'm joined once again by my colleague, Mr. David Holmes. Good afternoon, Dave.
Good afternoon. Are you well?
I'm very well, thank you. Prepared for this session that we've put together on PCI DSS version 4. Now, we wanted to pull this together because obviously it's all happening at the minute in that regard. But unfortunately, our QSAs within the business could not make it. However, we are absolutely delighted to be joined by Mr. Stuart Golding, who's very kindly agreed to come and talk to us about PCI DSS this afternoon. Good afternoon, Stuart.
Good afternoon. Thanks very much for inviting me.
No, thank you for coming on. So we'll get into your background in just a second, Stuart, and we'll talk. We'll get straight into talking about payment card industry data security standard. But before we do, just a couple of points of admin. If you're new to these sessions, well, first of all, welcome along. It's lovely to have you with us. These are very informal chats that we like to have about a range of topics, whether it's privacy, data protection, or as we say today, the PCI DSS. We do like to record these and put them out afterwards in the form of the podcast. There's a privacy notice on screen relating to that now. So just let us know if you've got any issues at all in that respect. And final thing before we get in, obviously, these are not our sessions. They're very much yours, the audience. So please do get involved. Comments, queries, questions, concerns, anything at all, either pop them in the chat. I'll keep an eye on that and raise them at the right interval, or raise your hand, unmute, get stuck in. We always find that the sessions go so much better when we've got really good interaction. Before we talk PCI DSS, we sometimes like to do a little bit of what's been in the news, and we'll try and keep it short this week because we've got plenty to talk about. But Dave, I know that there's one thing that you wanted to cover before we got stuck in.
Yeah, for sure. It was well, I'd seen on the internet, and anybody who I'm linked with on LinkedIn will have seen that I've reshared it earlier in the week. And it was an article highlighting that the French Data Protection Authority fines a data processor for failing to enter into a data processing agreement. And the article is dated the 27th of April, 2022. Now, CNIL, so it's the French regulator, so the CNIL fined the processor in late April, €1.5 million. So breaching Article 28.3, Article 29 and Article 32, as we know, which is the security one. And it was all triggered from a data breach, which led to sensitive data on around about 500,000 people being disclosed through data exfiltration from a poorly protected server. So that nicely links when we start talking about PCI and server security and bits and pieces, but we'll come back to that one once we've finished having our chat about what's in the news and things. By all accounts, the security concerns were also raised back as far as March 2020, according to the article. So there's several security failings, and it's a really interesting article to kind of read through. There's certainly lots of learning there for both controllers and for processors when it looks to appropriate security measures, and that controllers and processors must walk the walk and not just talk the talk, and it gives you some guidance around that. And furthermore, it held That the Article 28.3, as you know, for debt processing agreements under the GDPR, so it's been held that it does not clearly state whether one or both controller and processor are responsible for ensuring the existence of the agreement, and the European Data Protection Board and its guidelines back in 2020 on the concepts of controller and processor provides that both the controller and processor are responsible for ensuring that there's a contract or other legal act governing the processing. So it's really a lot of detail in there that's really useful to go and read. More than happy to pop the link into the chat once Oliver gets underway with the main part of the section after we've finished talking about the news. But it is a really fascinating case to read. There's always learning to take from both. From instances like this, both for the controllers and for processors. And as my little rant on LinkedIn started to move on to, it's a question really was at what point will organisations start taking data protection, security, privacy and treating it with an equal focus as compliance with financial regulations, health and safety regulations or other such regulations, for leading partly into a rant around the fact that it's in my eyes at least, privacy, data protection, information security is a regulation with equal weight to those, and we need to start taking it just as seriously.
Yeah, 100%. No, thanks for that, Dave. And if you wouldn't mind sharing the link, actually, that'd be much appreciated, and we'll make that available as widely as we can. I don't know if there's anything you wanted to discuss on that particular point, Stuart, but there's another piece I quickly wanted to bring up before we move on. I don't know if there was anything specifically that you've been dealing with this week that you want to raise more broadly.
I have been working with a client who is recovering from a ransomware attack, so I won't go into any of the detail, but it's all I really want to say is they are real. Ransomware attacks are real. I've felt the pain over the last 2 weeks along with this client, and as have their IT team, and they've effectively had to rebuild their entire back end network. Fortunately, they had quite a recent data set that they could recover from, but it has been very hard work, and it has been very disruptive to the business, and the business had to close down for 2 weeks whilst we rebuilt the whole of the back end systems to be able to service customers. So all I really just wanted to say was I've had recent experience. It is real. All of the things that your information security professionals tell you need to do in terms of not clicking on phishing emails, managing your access controls, everything that we tell you to do, really must do it, because these things are real. That's all I wanted to say.
No, absolutely. And you're quite right. You know, it's sometimes easy to think that threat is a bit more remote than it actually is. The only thing I wanted to raise, and actually there's a little bit of a segue here when we're talking about not necessarily ransomware, but ransoms generally. This isn't necessarily news. I think it's actually a hearing that happened back in March, but Carrie shared it with us. Our very own Carrie James, one of our colleagues, shared this with us early in the week, which we thought was fascinating. So it's I think it's a High Court case in the UK. I'll share the link in the chat here, but the essence of it, without getting into too much detail, because it's quite relatively long. I'll skip a lot of the detail, but the core of it is that a law firm made available footage of a claimant to a different claimant, effectively, essentially shared, you know, footage, personal data with someone they shouldn't have shared it with, and then subsequently this, you know, person who had incorrectly received the information refused to delete it. You know, they basically took a stand, whether it's, you know, they considered themselves to be doing it on sort of broader moral grounds, but they basically said, no, I'm not deleting it. You can't make demands of me. You know, unless you get the police involved or the court involved, then I won't be doing anything. And this did eventually end up in court. And there's a number of really interesting things in there. And I mean, the only frustration really is that once again, we've not seen Section 170 of the Data Protection Act used, where it very much could have been used. But I would urge you all to go and read up on that particular case, because there's a number of learning points which I think are worth raising in there. Andy's saying that in January they completed a cyber ransomware exercise with our exec and trustees, and a really good way to show them why they need to understand cyber and privacy. Yeah, if you can get that buy-in, that's always always valuable. Well, I'll tell you what, before we spend too long talking about news, I suggest we get right into the main topic of today. We've got a relatively busy session. I'm sure everyone's here to talk PCI DSS rather than bits and pieces that we've come across during the week. So I thought it was probably worth starting with, because as I mentioned to you, Stuart, off air, our community, although it's slightly different today, but our community tends to be privacy practitioners, DPOs, and there are exceptions to that rule, but not all of us are necessarily incredibly well versed in something like the PCI DSS. So I thought it was worth taking it back a little bit and talking about fundamentally what this standard is, you know, who it applies to, what it applies to, how it's constructed, what it looks like, and fundamentally, you know, how it's enforced perhaps, and just some of the real basics around it, because ultimately it's about payment card data, right? And it's a, yeah, it's a set of controls which regulate how those who handle card payments do so fundamentally.
Absolutely. So shall I quickly just talk at a high level about what PCI is about, and then sort of attach that to version 4 and then
absolutely, yeah.
Okay. So let's leave version 4 for the time being. Let's just talk about PCI, because regardless of version 4, PCI DSS is fundamentally the same thing. It is about making sure that merchants of any size all across the world who take credit and debit cards are putting controls in into their environments, into their systems, people, process and technology controls to make sure that those cards cannot be compromised. That's the aim of the game. In terms of who tells us we have to do this, it's a contractual obligation we have with our acquiring banks if we're a merchant. And the acquiring banks have contracts with the card schemes to tell them that they have to get their merchant community to be PCI DSS compliant. So it's not a regulatory thing, it's not a legal thing, it's a contractual obligation which is passed from the card schemes through the acquirers, and the acquirers pass those contractual obligations on to the merchants. So if anybody is ever going to come after you to say you've got to be PCI compliant, it should be your acquiring bank that is doing that and nobody else. If you're a third party service provider or you work alongside other companies and you procure or you process or transmit or store cardholder data on behalf of one of those companies, then you are probably likely to be asked to be PCI compliant by one of those companies, because they're being asked to be PCI compliant by their acquiring bank. So that's the really sort of high level what it's all about, and who makes you do it, who enforces it on you. I think
if I can just jump in there, Stuart, as well. You say it's not the law, it's not a regulatory thing, it's just a contractual thing, and it's only the acquiring banks that can, in essence, kind of enforce it. Just from your own knowledge, because I and it's really interesting having you on, because and so I can kind of discuss these things with you, because I'm not PCI in that sense. I know a little bit about it. But if you were found that you weren't complying and things like that, if it's only contractual, is that just a straight breach of contract then, or are there any other penalties that you could face for not being compliant with PCI?
There are none of the card schemes have been known to fine anybody for non-compliance for probably 5 or so years. Visa Europe, when Visa Europe was a thing, probably 4 or 5 years ago now, they decided to take away non-compliance penalties. And whilst MasterCard haven't formally said the same, they haven't penalised anybody for not being compliant over that same period of time. What Visa did do was they upped the financial penalty if you were breached. So that was as a response to merchants who had said we're spending too much time convincing our boards that we should be compliant, trying to talk to them about the cost of penalties if we're not compliant, when we should be spending time on making sure we are compliant. We'll happily pay more if we're found to be in breach or when we're breached, but we can you dispense with breaches for non-compliance? That's effectively what Visa Europe did. And Visa Inc., who took over, bought out and took over Visa Europe, have fundamentally maintained the same stance. So it's very, very unlikely that you would be penalized for non-compliance. But it is very likely and almost certain that you would be you would suffer a penalty from the card brands if you are breached, so if the cardholder data is compromised. And that can be that MasterCard's charge in a different structure to Visa, but it's generally charged per card. And I think, I haven't looked at the charges recently, but I think it's between 3 and €5 a card, depending on whether it's MasterCard or Visa. If you're found to be in breach of the PAN, the main 16-digit card number, and the CVV2 number, which is the three-digit card number on the back of the card on the signature strip, if you're found to be in that you've got CVV data that's compromised, then the penalty goes up, and I believe it's €20 a record from Visa. They're the numbers I remember from a couple of years ago. I haven't looked at those to see what those penalties are at the moment.
Okay. Very interesting.
It is interesting, that, Dave, and thanks for that, Stuart. I think one of the things that's interesting is, and we wanted to talk a little bit about this later, but it's probably worth drawing the parallel at this early stage, is that, you know, obviously we're privacy guys, as I mentioned before, so, you know, our framework of reference, if you like, fundamentally, or at least one of our key frameworks of reference, is going to be the GDPR.
Yeah.
And it is very much interesting that, you know, we talk about, in effect, you know, the penalty system might actually be the same in practice, but from a conceptual point of view, it's different. So you're saying there that you can't really be penalized, or you can't be penalized at all for non-compliance, but you will be if you're found in breach.
Yeah.
Obviously, that's not the case with the GDPR. The fine system extends to both non-compliances and personal data breaches.
Yes.
But I think it's interesting that practically from an enforcement perspective, and certainly in this country, you would only really incur any sort of regulatory action if you actually suffered a breach, right? Relatively rare that the ICO takes upon themselves to go and investigate something unless there's been some sort of instance. Right. So just an interesting parallel to draw, and I'm sure we'll come back to that. Andy mentions the fact that they can that the banks will stop you processing transactions as well if you're found in breach. Is that the case?
They have that power to do so if they wish to. I've never heard of any merchant suffering from that, but it's obviously, yeah, it's a contractual thing that the acquiring bank has with a merchant. Like you said, if you are in breach of contract, i.e. you have allowed cardholder data to be compromised, then one assumes the acquiring bank can call in that contractual obligation and prevent you from processing transactions. But like I say, I've never known of anybody to do that. If anybody has got examples of that, then please bring them forward.
And one final one for me on this, just on this bit before we move on into other bits that we've got for around PCI. As you know, with the GDPR, if it's a reportable incident or a notifiable incident to the ICO, sometimes, depending what section, you may find that's also a trigger notification for other regulators. So if you just look to the example of British Airways and the fine that had for it's around about 20 million quid, I think, wasn't it? Eventually for the card payment loss, yeah, or the loss of card payment data. Did PCI get involved at that point as well on a PCI and NCS in British Airways because that was a breach of card payment data as well as a regulator, or do the two tend to come hand in hand?
No, so if you're like British Airways and you suffer that sort of breach, you are likely to get almost certain to get a penalty from the card brands, Visa, MasterCard, Amex, if you take Amex and the other brands. And then the ISO can slap another penalty on you, which is completely separate and over above what you get penalised from the card schemes. So they're two separate things.
In addition to that, you then got potentially the compensation claims on top of that from individuals.
Absolutely. Wow. Yeah. So you've got over and above penalties, you're probably going to spend as much in sorting the mess out, as it were, compensating individuals, the cost of remediating. Because if you are in breach, if you do have cardholder data breached, your acquirer is more than likely going to tell you have to achieve compliance, full compliance, within 90 days of that breach being notified to them, which is obviously 3 months. What that would mean for most organisations is that they would have to probably close down a lot of their other projects and development work streams and focus everything on the becoming PCI DSS compliant. Now, if you're an organisation who is either not moving towards PCI compliant or partway through your PCI compliance programme, having to be compliant within 90 days is a huge ask. It's a big outlay. It's a big effort. So it's not just the penalties that you get, the costs of legal advice and compensation and other things customer facing. It's also the cost internally to your business of what you need to do to bring yourself up to a compliant status in a very short space of time. And I think, I'm not sure which of the cards, I think some, I have seen where card brands have levied penalties on merchants for breaches. And then those penalties have doubled every, they set a period by which the merchant has to be compliant by. Normally it starts at 90 days. And the penalties double after, if they haven't achieved that, and they double every time that that amount of time goes past again before the merchant is compliant. So these penalties can build up if you don't achieve your compliance objectives as set to you by the card schemes within that first 90 days. So it can get very expensive.
Really, really the potential to spiral there, I suppose. And
absolutely.
And I mean, if you also combine that with, you know, we mentioned that, getting a little bit of feedback, sorry if you just give me a split second, but we also mentioned the fact that in theory at least they have the power to stop you processing transactions. So really, if you could combine all of that, and Ian's also saying that apparently MasterCard always used to charge back to you the fraudulent amount spent on a card that was
right.
theirs,
yeah,
which
they
again
do that. They can reserve the right to do all of those things under the contract, whatever your contract is, through your acquirer. So the contract the MasterCard would have would always be with acquiring banks. And then if an acquiring bank is penalised by MasterCard, the acquiring bank will always look to pass on those penalties to the merchant in question to recoup their losses effectively.
Yeah, no, for sure. So really, as you say, I mean, that's what's partly interesting about this is that ultimately, as it's contractual, there's a real leeway for the acquiring banks to sort of enforce it how they see fit, I suppose, in that sense.
There is.
One of the things I wanted to touch on, just because you mentioned and you spoke about, you know, being compliant with the standard, and I suppose it's just worth, before we get onto version 4, which is just around the corner, before we get on to that, just talking about what do we mean by compliance and what that looks like, because one of the acronyms that's often, you know, floated around in this context, the acronym QSA, which meant nothing to me until, you know, I started looking at this more. But what does, you know, compliance actually look like? What does the journey look like? And then what's actually the process behind that? At what point can you confidently say that you are compliant with the standard?
Yeah. Okay. So what does the journey look like? Well, if I was going to come into any one of your organizations as a merchant and help you to achieve PCI compliance, first thing we do is a gap analysis. We treat PCI very, you know, not dissimilar to how we'd treat ISO 27001 or Cyber Essentials or any other security controls framework. We do a gap analysis first. We interview people within your organization to understand what was in place and what's not in place against the PCI standard. And there are, I think, in the current version, there are about 200, just under 290 individual controls. In version 4, I think that goes up to somewhere around 300. I haven't actually sat down and counted them all yet. So we'd go through all of those and we'd see where you were. We'd also break it down into channels. So we would look at your face-to-face channel if you've got shops. We would look at your online channel if you're selling on the internet. And we would look at your a mail order and telephone order channel, which is effectively your call, anything you do through telephone orders, any orders you take over telephone, so call centers, that type of thing. So we'd split it down into those component parts. If you had a number of websites trading separately, then we'd look at each one of those separately, because it's far easier to manage a PCI compliance journey if you break it up into different sections. And then what you would do is you would assess compliance against each one of those channels, or each one of those payment channels, against the, let's call it 290 controls at the moment. Then we'd set about setting up a remediation program, which would be a mix of technical solutions, of people solutions and process solutions to fix the gaps that we find. And PCI doesn't really require anything that's significantly different from ISO 27001 and a number of other control frameworks. You know, it needs policy and procedure at the heart of everything. It needs process. It needs you to make sure that you are controlling access to all your systems, that you've got privileged access locked down, that you're controlling that and managing it very closely on a regular basis. The current version requires multi-factor authentication on administrator accounts. Version 4 will require multi-factor authentication on all accounts, whether it's a user account or an administrator account. on everything which is in the cardholder data environment. One thing I haven't mentioned is scoping. So we probably do that before we do the gap analysis. The first thing we do is identify what is really your cardholder data environment. So where are you taking cardholder data, and where does that cardholder data flow through your organization? Which systems does it touch? Which people does it touch? And which processes does it touch? And that becomes your cardholder data environment. And then anything that's outside of that environment and is segregated outside of that environment and you can prove as such, doesn't have to be controlled in the same way that your cardholder data environment does under the PCI DSS controls. Now, again, like I've already mentioned, if you're doing ISO 27001 or another control framework, NIST, for example, or SOC 2, you'll be implementing controls very similar that PCI requires across your whole environment, regardless of it being PCI DSS cardholder data environment or otherwise. So if you're doing one of those programs, or if you're already compliant with one of those control frameworks, you have certification, it's very likely that you've done an awful lot that will achieve PCI compliance as well. So, you know, I have known organizations who have had a separate ISO 27001 program, a separate PCI program, and a separate GDPR program. And I'd strongly advise you not to do that. I'd strongly advise you to look at where the synergies are, what are the same controls in effect, and what you can do once rather than twice or three times. So policies are a case in point. You know, you don't need a separate set of PCI policies. You can incorporate all the PCI requirements or the policy requirements into your existing information security policy set and absorb them into there. When I write policy sets for people, I even if they're not taking cardholder data, we still give them policies which have PCI DSS clauses in there, so that as and when and if they do start taking cards for payment, it's in there, it's ready, and it's good to go. A lot of things are the same.
It's really interesting listening to you say that, because there are a lot of synergies when you're just talking there about if you just look at the GDPR and things in particular, just for some of the audience, we've got GDPR frameworks, you've got policies and procedures, you should have cyclical kind of compliance reviews, and you should be assessing whether the controls in place are effective and things like that. But as you know, the GDPR is quite risk-based approach, so some of the controls may be quite subjective. So with PCI, are we looking at more kind of rule-based standards and more kind of binary, you're compliant, PCI, you're not compliant, that kind of?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're absolutely right. Lots of those other control frameworks are, there's a certain element of subjectivity to them. And it's all about, you know, sort of, if you're auditing those, to prove that you are meeting the intent of the control. With PCI compliance, you have to meet the intent of the control. It is black and white. You either are compliant or you're not with every control. So there is no question. There is no ifs, buts or maybes. You have to be compliant with each one of those controls. So talking about Oliver, you asked me about, or you mentioned the term QSA, Qualified Security Assessor.
Yes.
Yep. So if you're a merchant who is taking 6 million transactions per year or more, then you're classed as a level one merchant. And in almost all cases, you need to be assessed as PCI compliant by a Qualified Security Assessor who will do an audit on you. And he or she will provide you with an attestation of compliance and a report on compliance that details everything you've done to achieve compliance, details your scope, and they provide that certification for you, which you can then pass on to your acquiring banks, and your acquiring banks accept you as being PCI compliant. Now, if you are a merchant who is taking 1 million transactions or less, you fall into one of three other categories, whether it be a tier three, a level three, a level two, a level three, or a level four merchant. And in that case, you do have the option to do a self-assessment questionnaire. So you can self-assess yourself without the use of a qualified security assessor externally. Now, that's fine, but every qualified security assessor I've ever talked to says that where they have been asked to go into a merchant after a breach, particularly where a merchant has certified, self-certified with an SAQ, they have found the merchant to be woefully inadequately compliant. And it's true that, you know, when you're marking your own homework and you're providing your own evidence and you're ticking boxes to say, yes, we do this control, yes, we do that control, it's not as, however hard we try, it's not as rigorous as an external third party doing your assessment for you.
So
yeah, if you sit in that category where you are a level one merchant, you in pretty much every case now you have to have a QSA. And I think as a merchant in the lower levels, probably a level two merchant, which is 1 million to 6 million transactions, you'd probably want to work with a QSA as well in that instance as well, because you're probably going to have a pretty big network of systems, a pretty big cardholder data environment where cardholder data may be present, and you really want to make sure that you're doing the right thing and not just doing a tick box exercise and kind of kidding yourself that you might be compliant.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it's best not to mention tick box exercises or Dave absolutely flies into a rage.
And you know, one of the key things to achieving compliance is just trying to get rid of cardholder data out of your environment. So if you don't have cardholder data in your environment, you don't have to control it. So you know, most large merchants, so a lot that I've worked with in the last 13 years, and I'm talking some of the biggest supermarkets and high street chains that you will be aware of. You'll probably shop there quite regularly yourselves. Most of them have gone down a path of working with third-party service providers who take the payments effectively on their behalf, whether it be online or whether it be through the call centre or whether it be in the stores, where the card transaction is effectively encrypted at the point of the card being entered by the customer, whether it's at a PIN entry device or online, and taken somewhere else by a third party so that the card number never ever enters the merchant environment. And if the merchant needs a unique identifier around the card, then the card detail is tokenized and a tokenized value is passed back to the merchant along with the transaction details that they reconcile as usual. So they get a token, and a token is considered not cardholder data because it can't be returned back to cardholder data without the algorithms, etc., that create the token. So de-scoping is a very effective way of achieving PCI compliance. Now, it doesn't take the onus away or the responsibility, well, the accountability rather, away from the merchant. The merchant still has to do some things. There's nothing that takes 100% of those controls away from you as a merchant. But for example, if you use on your website a third-party hosted payment page or a third-party iframe where the customer is taken to that website of that third party to enter their cardholder details in, and they don't enter anything on your website at all, you are eligible for a control set, which is known as SAQA, which is 24 controls. And that's things like policy procedure, third-party management, incident response planning, staff training, and a responsibility matrix that sets out who's accountable for what parts of PCI compliance. And all but 24 of those controls become the responsibility of the third party who takes the cardholder data on your behalf, effectively. So that's a great way of moving scope. And another great thing that does is when version 4 becomes mandatory, it will be largely the third party service provider who will have to put in the controls, change the controls, increase the level of control that is required by version 4. A large onus of that goes on to these third party service providers that you've worked with. So that makes ongoing compliance significantly easier because you don't have that burden. You don't have to change so much. And whilst implementing a third-party payment service provider, whether it's online or a point-to-point encrypted solution, perhaps in stores, in face-to-face transactions, whilst that is costly, the ongoing maintenance of compliance by outscoping through a third party is, without a shadow of a doubt, going to be significantly cheaper than if you were to stay doing it yourself and testing it yourself every year. I've done that exercise with a number of the clients I've worked with and proven that to get investment in the first place. And, you know, it's absolutely the case. It takes away a huge amount of headache.
Yeah.
Well, that's really, really interesting. So from the sound of it, I'm right. You're kind of saying that there's really no exemptions. Everybody's caught if you're doing card payment data. But the way
no exemptions whatsoever, I'm afraid.
But the way you can help yourself a little bit is by not having everything in scope, and if you can narrow the scope, that kind of makes it a lot easier and that kind of stuff. So looking at narrowing the scope and that kind of thing, just before we start, and we should really kind of move on to some of the version 4 stuff, I think, but other than kind of defining the scope and narrowing the scope, is there any other kind of common poorly implemented controls that you've seen, just as an overview, some of the common pitfalls that people fall into? Obviously, it sounds like the scope may be one of them with what you've just said. Are there any other kind of headline areas that people normally get tripped up with when trying to do this kind of thing?
Yeah, I guess so. I'm just looking on the chat. Before I go into that question, Rob Wilkinson has said, worth mentioning ISAs. So we talked about QSAs, Qualified Security Assessors. An ISA is an internal security assessor. So you, as an organisation, you can get an individual or individuals in your organisation trained at a very, very similar level to a Qualified Security Assessor who's external. And your internal security assessor can do your assessments for you. They're not backed by a company who is a qualified security assessor, but they are qualified to do that. And it's very good practice to have an ISA in your organization, particularly if you're a big organization with lots of payment channels, to be able to talk the same language as a qualified security assessor, your external assessor, and also to help and guide and advise you through your journey from that kind of perspective. So Rob, hope that's covered that one quite quickly, but nonetheless covered.
No, absolutely.
So the question was about are there any major pitfalls, wasn't it?
Kind of common pitfalls with scoping, because you mentioned obviously that you could narrow the scope by having a third party provider kind of do that for you, that kind of thing. But do you find any of the pitfalls where people might be thinking, when we're looking at the scope, potentially monitoring servers, are they really caught by the PCI or policy and procedure framework falling down, or any other kind of top level kind of bits that you often find that?
Sure. You've mentioned a few sort of types of controls there. It's the same as if you're doing ISO 27001 or any other control framework. It's a layered approach. So, you know, the policies are essential, but then you've got to implement those policies. You've got to train people on those policies, and you've got to train everybody how to handle cardholder data or not if you've moved it out of your environment. So it's a similar kind of approach. Some of the pitfalls that I see, I have seen customers who have gone through all the controls, spent a lot of money and time and effort, you know, 2 or 3 years getting themselves compliant. But then they find that they've got an old redundant database, which is carrying thousands, millions, I think I've seen, of old cardholder data. If you're carrying that, you will be non-compliant. So you do need to do, as well as taking out of scope everything that is kind of current and future in terms of payments, you do need to do data scans. You need to check all of your current environments, all of your storage, to make sure there's no cardholder data stored that you didn't even realize you had. More often than not, particularly in big organizations, you know, cardholder data has in the past been used for analysis and all sorts of business legitimate things, but people take extracts of cardholder data, they dump it into spreadsheets, put it in files, use it for what they want, and then forget about it. It's not properly deleted or cleared down afterwards, and that will definitely catch you out. And you need to be able to prove to your QSA that you have done that type of exercise to make sure that you're not carrying cardholder data, archived old cardholder data. And the reason that's still important, even though majority of those cards won't work, because the cards that sourced that data in the first place have probably gone out of date. I couldn't tell you which ones do, but some of the card brands, some of the issuers do recycle numbers after a period of time. So they could still be, it could be a source of data that could be used in the future, so that's really important to get rid of that. That's one sort of gotcha. What else is there?
I think that sort of echoes to an extent, I think, what Ian's saying in the chat, which is that for him the biggest pitfall is organizations treating it like a tech project rather than a business project, which
that's a very, very good point.
Treat other sort of risk management exercises, and that all too often the problem is you get yourself compliant, or you get yourself seemingly compliant, you tick all the boxes, you know?
Yep.
And then, you
Stop
know,
it, next, Eddie.
sorry. And next year, you know, you fall flat on your face because you've not actually embedded the changes, you know, is really at the core of all of these risk management frameworks. Just before we move on, for those of you who are interested in ISO 27001 specifically, just because we mentioned it there, we did speak to Stuart Barker last week about that. That's available on the podcast feed for anyone who's interested. Would highly recommend. That was a really good chat. So those are some of the pitfalls. I don't know if there were any others that you wanted to mention specifically, Stuart, but if not, I'm just conscious of time. We probably need to get on to talking a little bit about version 4, because really, I think the main things for me when talking about this, because I'm reluctant to get into necessarily the very the minutiae of it. I don't necessarily think we need to talk about individual controls changing and what that looks like. But I think possibly, you know, first of all, why do we update this? I mean, you mentioned a second ago, actually, and I thought that was interesting, that we're moving from a relatively limited implementation of multi-factor authentication to one across the board. So
yeah,
I suppose, is it the case that these updates to the standard just follow, you know, technological advances to a certain extent?
Absolutely, definitely. Yes.
Easy one to answer, but I suppose that's one of the things I wanted to cover. But then also, you know, what are some of the key changes? You mentioned that one, but we were also talking about encryption off air previously. And ultimately, what are the timeframes like, and how do we prepare? I suppose you mentioned the gap analysis, which I guess is really the place to start, isn't
it? You know? Absolutely. Well, okay, so let's talk about four. Let's kind of frame it. So version 4 is the biggest change that's happened since 2005, when PCI DSS was first launched upon us all as merchants who take card payment. So it is a big, big change. However, saying that, an awful lot of it hasn't changed. So there's still 12 principal requirements. You still have to do your scoping and your definition piece. You still have to do a ROC and an AOC. It still has to be assessed by QSAs or ISAs, and there will still be self-assessment questionnaires, which you can use if you wish to. And they're very useful to kind of frameworks for different payment channels. So none of that has changed. It is still there to protect cardholder data, and it's still the responsibility of the merchant to do that. Now, in terms of timescales, you can attest against the current version 3.2.1 right up until the 31st of March 2024, when that version, what we're calling now the old version or the existing the old version, is retired. That date won't slip. That won't change. There won't be any tolerance on that whatsoever. From that date, you will need to the day after, effectively the 1st of April 2024. When you're attesting your compliance, you will have to attest against version 4 from that date. There will be a number of future dated requirements, or there are a number of future dated requirements, and these are things where the card industry, the brands who have created this standard, and the PCI Security Standards Council, these are ones where they consider them to be quite significant in how much they're going to take for merchants to implement. So they've given us another year, 31st of March 2025, to implement those. Again, I don't know how many of them there are. In previous big version changes, there's been up to 20 of those, but I haven't gone through yet in detail and looked through to see exactly how many of those there are. So it feels a long way off. 31st of March 2024, you know, 2 years away, sounds an awful long way away. But any of you who have done any sort of implementation of information security standards will know that time very, very, very quickly comes around, particularly if it's big projects that you're looking to deliver. Now, I mentioned taking things out of scope in the past. I would very, very, very much encourage organisations who haven't de-scoped by using validated third-party service providers to really look at that this time around, to understand whether the cost of doing that compares favourably or better than the cost of you having to implement these changed and new requirements, because there are, and we won't get into the nitty-gritty, we won't have time to go into the individual requirements, but there are a number of requirements which could create you significant additional cost to implement. Like I said, we won't go into the details. So back to the gap analysis, this is what I'm recommending all the clients I'm working with who are doing PCI compliance, either are compliant or are partway through their journey, is to get a copy of the version 4, which is freely available now on the Security Standard Council's website, and start doing that gap analysis against where you are now versus where you will need to be from April the 1st, 2024, and then subsequently 31st of March 2025. Because if you don't know what you've got to do differently, you can't put a plan in place to get you there. And when you're looking through and doing that gap analysis, you need to be thinking to yourself, okay, which ones of these are going to take us longest to do or going to be most costly to do? And they're the ones you need to be picking up and thinking, right, we need to take some action on those fairly quickly, because they may take a considerable amount of time to do. And there are some, but that will be the case when you look at some of the detail. So, yeah, it's all about getting hold of the documentation and doing a gap analysis and putting a plan in place which prioritises the things that are going to be either costly or a long time to do. And, the cost thing is important because we all have budget cycles. The bigger the company, the longer the budget cycle takes. And we have to take time to get budget approved to do things. And doing PCI DSS will probably impact other things that you might want to have in your plan. IT or otherwise. So it's important you think about those considerations as well as early as you possibly can. So I'll be encouraging all my clients within the next couple of months to really start looking in detail at what that means for them. Now you can't, well, theoretically you can attest to version 4 right now, but in practicality you can't, because if you want to do a self-assessment, then the self-assessment questionnaires don't exist yet. They still have to write those. And if you want to use a QSA, you can't have a QSA assess you yet because none of the QSAs have been trained on version 4 yet. That training, I believe, is starting in June this year. And not too long after that, we will have QSAs who are fully trained and will be able to attest you as compliant. There's also the question around the deadline. Do I attest compliance against the current version, 3.2.1, up to and including the 31st of March 2024, to give myself an additional year's breathing space before I have to mandatory attest to version 4. And that's absolutely a strategy that you could employ, that's great, but don't gamble and leave yourself that in the last month of or the last few days of March 2024 to get that attestation done. Because if you go over that date, your QSA, if you're using a QSA, even your ISA, will have to say, I'm sorry, we cannot, that has been retired, that is not relevant anymore, and we have to attest against version 4 from 1st of April. So don't gamble, whatever you do. If you're planning to attest to 3.2.1 coming up to that March date, I would strongly recommend you aim to do it in the January of that year to give yourself some contingency. So that's January 2024, give yourself some contingency so you don't catch yourself out and make it very difficult for yourself. If that's of course if you are already compliant and you are reattesting that compliance in that time frame. So again, just you can strategically work it that way, but think very carefully about what that's going to take to do, and don't get caught out.
I think that's really useful advice. Is kind of, yes, we've got a 2 year, like to 2024 roughly, or maybe just under 2 years before version 4 comes out. It's you really shouldn't be sitting on your laurels and that kind of thing. So I think that's really, really useful advice that we need to start thinking about and doing something quite soon in order to give you the best possible time to address what the changes are. Just one question for me, that you focus on 2024, you've got these new changes coming through. Are all the controls implemented at the point that it becomes the go live date, if you like, for version 4, or are there some that tripping over? I know you mentioned 2025 there in your comments. Is 2025 referring to a kind of a similar cycle process, or referring to updated or different controls that maybe apply from the following year?
All of the controls, well, like I said, PCI hasn't fundamentally changed in its intent and what it's trying to do. And whilst version 4, if you're familiar with version 3.2.1, if you look at version 4, there are some significant changes in the layout. And if you were to read through every single requirement, you'd find that every single requirement has been rewritten. But some of those rewrites are just dotting the T's, crossing the I's, and just changing or clarifying some of what was intended. So if you're compliant at the moment with 3.2.1, when you get to the 31st of March 2024, they will still be valid, but there are changes to a number of, and again, I haven't counted the number, there are changes to a number of those existing requirements, which effectively require you to do more of, or beef up what you're doing, like the one I talked about, multi-factor authentication. We've got two-factor authentication as a requirement now. It will change to requiring two-factor / multi-factor authentication on everything, not just user accounts. Another change just flipped through my head then. Oh yeah, password length. The current PCI says password length needs to be 8 characters. The new one says 12. So that's a four character change. That's something that, you know, as an organization, you'll need to look at all of your systems that sit in the cardholder data environment and say to yourself, do these systems cope with a 12 character password? What do we need to do to train our staff to use a 12 character secure password instead of an 8 character secure password? So it's those type of things which are existing very much now, but they're going to become a little bit harder to do because the control requirement gets a little bit more difficult, and it adds some things. You know, the MFA one, how many of your systems in the cardholder data environment have multi-factor authentication as part of their build, and how can you switch that on? Anybody who's done a multi-factor authentication rollout on something like Microsoft 365 or something similar, obviously depending on the number of people in your estate, anybody who's done that type of exercise will know how long it takes to A, make sure it works in all the systems, and B, roll it out to all your users and get them confident in using it so it doesn't impact business on a day-to-day basis. So they're just a couple of examples of things that, you know, are made harder because they're made, the controls are made harder for all the right reasons, the same as they would be in any control framework. When it comes to 2025, all of the requirements that come into force and are mandatory from March 2025 onwards are already there in the standards now, and they are highlighted as requirements that aren't mandatory until that date. So there's nothing to stop you implementing them until then. And again, that would be my advice: get on and implement them as soon as you can. You know, build them into your plans, build them into your projects and your requirements in your projects as early as you possibly can, and get them in as early as you possibly can.
No, yeah. Very good. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Just an interesting point there. So Ian's mentioned in the chat there that they've just implemented MFA, and without it, they'd have seen a marked increase in cost for their business insurance. That's particularly interesting.
That is an interesting one. Yeah, anybody
knock on effect
to get insurance, cybersecurity insurance or breach insurance or anything like that, your insurance company will set you a whole bunch of criteria. And you know, lots of insurance companies are now saying to organizations, you need to be compliant with ISO 27001 or PCI DSS if you're taking cardholder detail, et cetera, et cetera. Absolutely. Your insurance premiums may be significantly reduced if you are compliant with standards, if you've implemented things like multi-factor authentication and so on. Most definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose then the flip side of it is, and this is kind of what we've mentioned already, is that there are always parallels to be drawn with, whether it's other risk management frameworks or other standards or regulations. And obviously, if, you know, that's a prime example, MFA, because if you've deployed MFA across the business, regardless of whether it's required for version 4 or not, that's not just going to help you from a PCI point of view, but from from an Article 32 GDPR point of view, from a technical control point of view, potentially for ISO 27001, et cetera, et cetera, whether it's SOC 2. And I think that probably really speaks to the point you made earlier, Stuart, which is try and integrate these projects where possible. You know, there's going to be overlap. Don't let that be something which, you know, is ultimately a thorn in your side. Let it be an advantage. There's overlap. Let's take advantage of that.
Exactly. And most QSA companies, if you're working with a QSA company to implement PCI, and again, you know, we've only talked about a QSA in the context of them doing your audit, marking your homework, but it's quite acceptable and it's quite okay to use the same QSA to be your trusted advisor through the course of your implementation in your project. And that's what I've done in everything I've ever done with a client. We've always had a qualified security assessor on hand, contracted to support that project. And so I've worked with lots of different QSA companies, and that works very well. And most QSAs, what was the point I was getting to? Oh yeah, most QSAs will have already done a mapping against PCI, against ISO 27001, against Cyber Essentials and GDPR. And they should be able to work with you quite comfortably to be able to identify very clearly what are the common threads through all of that. You know, where you need an information security policy, well, you need that for all four of those standards. You need other policies, information security policies as part of that set, which cover specifics for specific things. But working with a QSA anybody who is working with you to put ISO 27001 in, for example, I would be quite surprised if they didn't already have a mapping of PCI against those other standards, or be able to access one very clearly. And that will obviously help you to understand what you need to do once and what you need to do separately for the individual standards.
Yeah, and I think our sales and marketing guys will never forgive me if I don't mention at this point that we're a QSA company. So if any of this is ringing a bell to any of you listening to this, then please do get in touch. And ourselves and Stuart as well can very much help you with any issues you've got from a PCI perspective, any aspects of the project. There's one thing I want to pick up here, because Dave Anthony in the chat mentions that there can be issues where different frameworks conflict, i.e. password complexity and reset times. But is that potentially an issue? I'd have thought that you just sort of operate to the highest caliber if you're operating between frameworks. So go on, Stuart.
You're absolutely right, Oliver. That would be my advice. You know, go with the highest, go with the hardest, and then you're going to meet all the others. Unless you've got systems that don't allow you to do that, and then you have to then you have to justify that to your auditor. Go with the toughest one, and you've pretty much covered everything on the other one.
Yeah, and that point about systems actually is a very good one. And Dave, this is where I'd like to bring you in, actually, just again when we're talking about parallels between the PCIDS specifically and the GDPR. But entirely illustrates the importance of data protection by design and by default. Because if you're not properly assessing and reviewing the systems you're putting in place, particularly, I guess if you're a bit blinkered to it, and the fact that you've not considered whether this particular system allows you to be able to comply with not just the GDPR but some of the wider standards, then you can put yourself in a really tricky place, right?
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, and PCI, you know, if you go into the council website, you can find documentation on there, which is really, really good about building software and with building security and by design, which is it's very relevant whether you're working in a PCI environment or not. The PCI DSS gives, and it's all free resource, this stuff. You know, you don't have to be signed up to the council or anything to get it. You can go on that website and there's some great stuff there. So, absolutely endorse that comment.
Yeah, no, 100%. I appreciate that we're running out of time. We've got a couple of minutes left, although obviously I'm happy to stick around and chat in theory all afternoon, but I'm sure not everyone has that luxury. Dave, anything from you on anything that we've discussed thus far, anything that we need to pick out? The one thing that I kind of wanted to talk about, although I'm not sure there was much in it and we've not had a chance to, was the idea that perhaps scoping is particularly important, and when we talk about the change in the landscape and the move to version 4, whether there's any consideration given to the fact that far more private individuals will be taking payments, or not private individuals, but far more smaller businesses, I think, will be taking card payments than ever before, particularly with, you know, sort of those third-party providers like Stripe, etc., really empowering people. I kind of wanted to talk about that, but I'm not sure how much there's in that, Stuart, really. I mean,
those very small merchants are still subject to PCI DSS compliance because they're taking cardholder data, and using things like Stripe and Square and those other little gadgets you see on market stalls and everywhere else nowadays, that is a third-party payment service provider who effectively takes cardholder data out of scope from that merchant. So they're fundamentally looking at a much reduced set of controls that they need to implement. And again, it comes down to things like policy, procedure, incident response planning, training of your staff, etc. Now, if you're a one-man band, you know, if you're someone making jam in your kitchen and you're selling it on a market every Sunday, you don't need to do things to the same extent as you would if you're a website or a store with multiple store shops. It's in put it in perspective and be sensible and pragmatic about it in terms of what you need to do. But yes, if you're a merchant taking card like that, you are still in scope. You still do need to achieve PCI compliant.
Yeah, no, 100%. 100%. So yeah, I to be honest, we could possibly even consider setting up a second session on this, because I think there's still plenty to talk about. I say, Dave, any closing thoughts from you on?
Yeah, I found it really, really interesting. It's been great having you on, and I certainly jump at another chance to understand some more around the details at another time. So, for example, I don't even know if he exists, but we looked at it being rule-based. We looked at there's a set of standards and things, but whether you could do compensatory controls. So as we can't necessarily do that, could we do something to kind of give effect to it, but maybe not exactly as it's written down, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so yeah, we haven't covered compensatory controls. And a big, big change to version 4, which we haven't even mentioned, is an alternative way of doing it, where you do have a choice of setting your own control frameworks and having a QSA assess against those framework. So that would be a worthy conversation for another time. I think if you were a small merchant, you wouldn't go down that route. If you're I think the terminology in the new standard is sophisticated merchant of a certain size, then you potentially would. But it's definitely something worth talking about. Compensated controls and the alternative approach, which are different but very similar.
So what I'm hearing here is that really, we've got scope to potentially organise another one of these episodes, because I think there's still loads to talk about. And actually,
like you say, we could talk all afternoon, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. And if anything, you know, if we give ourselves a little bit of time to get a bit more comfortable with version 4, I'd certainly appreciate that. But I think that's definitely something we can look at. On that note, Stuart, I'd like to thank you ever so much for your time and your insights this afternoon. It's been really, really excellent talking to you, as Dave says. If people want to get in touch with you, well, we can put you in touch, but if people want to reach out to you, is there any particular address they should be looking out for?
If you went to my give you my website details, that's probably the quickest way, and have a look on there.
We'll paste this all in the episode when it goes out.
It's www.ukdatasecure.com.
Fabulous. So yeah, we'll provide all the links to that, but as I say, failing that, if people just get in touch with us, we can put you in touch with Stuart.
Lovely.
There's no problem at all. We will be back next week with another episode. Next week, I think we've got one of our GDPR radios. I don't know if Miles is paying attention and can correct me on that. If not, but GDPR radio is one of our open surgery sessions where we talk all things privacy, news, views, etc. Even more relaxed than this. Is that right, producer Miles?
That is right. We have shifted things around a little bit so we can make Carrie Green. Available for the retentions and archiving session. So we've got GDPR radio next week on the 6th, and then on the 13th following that, we have a discussion on retention and archiving.
Fabulous. Thank you very much, Miles. So we'll be back for all of that very soon. If you want an invite to any of that, listeners, you can head to the DPP website events page. You can sign up there or reach out to us on any socials. And as I say, reach out to us if you'd like to find out more about PCI DSS and if you need any support with that from ourselves or Stuart. On that note, I think it only remains for me to wish you all a very relaxing, hopefully long weekend for the bank holiday. And I suppose we hope to see you all very soon.
Be sure. I'd very much echo that. I think from me, have a great weekend. And anybody who's in the PCI world looking at this, I would suggest you don't sit on your hands following the great advice from Stuart.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Stuart. Take care, all.